So this is Patient Care Theory 2, Unit 5, Part 2, Maternal Assessment. So what I mean by that is assessment of the pregnant patient, right? So we'll see a number of pregnant patients. It is a smaller percentage of our total call volume, but very few will deliver. But what's important to keep in mind is that when you and I get a call for a 911 call for a mom in labor, it's usually because it's been a complicated pregnancy, it's premature labor, there's a fetal breech position, or there's some other complication associated with the delivery, or mom's home alone and she has no transportation, and a cab drivers, I'll tell you, will refuse to deliver a mom who, sorry, they'll refuse to transport a mom who's in labor if she identifies herself in labor, and rightly so. You really want to take the liability of having a baby delivered in your cab? No. Maybe Uber's different, I don't know. But my point is that when you get a 911 call for an obstetrical patient, you should be a little bit worried. You should be thinking this could be complicated, there could be a neonatal resuscitation anticipated. But hopefully it'll be every delivery that I've been to where I've been the second car in, there haven't been that many, I've been maybe four or five. I've transported a lot of high-risk pregnancy patients when I worked in the helicopter, but the ones I've been on have all been pretty close to full term, normal delivery, no biggie, just, you know, labor came on too quickly for mom to get to the hospital and they call 911. So few will deliver. Few will involve complications with the mom or the baby. Now, hospital percentage, about 1%. Out of hospital is closer to about 6%. But whenever you get called for an OBS call, you have to be mentally and physically prepared to deliver a baby. I'll just tell you the one call that I did that was most unpleasant for me, not to mention mom. But we got called for a medical alert, which is always like an elderly fall, right? So a medical alert went off. And we got to this house, and we didn't know whether this was just a false alarm, because a lot of them are. So we went to the house, door of the house with no equipment. And we heard a faint voice, and the door was open. So we went into the house, we went upstairs, and there was a woman, probably in her late, I think she was in her late 30s, early 40s, and she was holding her stillborn baby. It was 19 weeks. It was dark, dark blue, and it was completely flaccid, and it was vital signs absent. And she was holding the baby, and she looked at us very upset and said, I can't bend over to give it mouth to mouth. And so I did a quick assessment and told her that her baby was dead. Not just like that, but a little, you know, more nicely. But I used the word dead because you can't use any other words. You can't say passed away or anything like that. You can't use metaphors. So I didn't resuscitate because of its gestational age, because it was completely blue, because it was completely flaccid. And I have to say the ride to the hospital was very uncomfortable. I had to send my partner running out to get the obstetric kit so we could cut the umbilical cord and take mom and this VSA baby downstairs. And after we got to the unit, one of the supervisors had heard the call and met us at the hospital and asked us if we needed some time off after this call. Like sometimes you can get a couple of hours or so just to kind of let the dust settle when you see something like that. And my first reaction was, my partner's reaction was, no, we're good. And I thought, yeah, if you don't mind, I think I might take 20 minutes because I want to speak to the obstetrician. So just to ease my own anxieties about the whole event, I went back into the hospital. I went to the desk and I asked the nurse if the obstetrician was around and could I speak to her. And she said, yeah. And so when I spoke to her, I said, as you know, we're the paramedics who brought mom and the baby in. I said, I said, the baby's 19 weeks was a dark, dark blue and vital signs absent. And I just want some honest feedback from you. Do you think I should have made an attempt to resuscitate?" And the obstetrician said, "Yeah, you should have. You killed that baby." No, she didn't say that. She said, no, not at all. She said, "I wouldn't have done anything different." She said, "Absolutely not." So.
Oh, shit.
Just like to keep you on your toes. Brock?
What do you do with the corpse? Do you like carry it with her to the hospital? Or like?
Well, so. Yeah. With the cord?
Yeah, with the corpse, like the dead towel.
Oh, the corpse. I thought you said the corpse. I wrapped it in a towel and held it all the way to the hospital. I thought about giving it to Mom, and to be honest, I didn't know what to do. Never dealt with anything like that before. I sat behind Mom. Part of me didn't want Mom to see the stillborn after, you know, she'd seen it initially, but part of me didn't want her to see it, and part of me thought I should have just asked her. I should have talked to her, and I talked to her a little bit from sitting behind her, and you know, asked her, "Is everything okay? Are you all right?" And but yeah, I just carried it. No family there. No, and so her elderly mom lived with them, and her elderly mom left the medical alarm at home, so she activated that. So that's how we end up getting the call. So, okay, so there are questions you're going to want to ask related to the pregnancy, and then there are questions you're going to ask related to the labor. Your first questions are going to be about the labor, because you want to know whether this is a call where you're going to stay at the scene and deliver the baby, or whether you're going to transport Mom. So you need to find that out immediately. And the two key questions to ask and the one key assessment to do are as follows. Do you feel the urge to push? Because the urge to push would suggest imminent delivery. Number two, has your water broken? Again, would suggest imminent delivery. And assessment, you need to assess for crowning. That means that you look at the vagina to see if you can see the head or presenting part. So you want to ask some other things about, have you had any mucus or bloody discharge? When did the contractions start? How far apart are the contractions? How long do they last? How would you rate the intensity of the contractions, 1 to 10 at the increasing intensity? Those sorts of things. But I didn't put it down here, but the immediate assessment you want to do if Mom has the urge to push is check to see if she's crowning. Now, every call is dynamic, right? If Mom is upstairs and walking and she's able to walk downstairs, I might just walk her downstairs. But before I do that, I might ask her, like, do you think the baby is coming? And if she says yes, then we'll stay upstairs and we'll, you know, put her on her bed. We can't put her on a stretcher because the stretcher is probably sitting outside the house, at the front of the house, but we'll deliver upstairs. But if she doesn't feel like it's happening right this second, we might just attempt to get downstairs, because getting from upstairs to downstairs can be a logistical nightmare. So in terms of history, you want to know if there's been any vaginal bleeding, number of sanitary pads used to control the bleeding, other vaginal discharges, color amount, duration. The maternal history, we want to ask things like, is this your first pregnancy? So the word gravid is used to describe pregnancies. So if a woman's been pregnant 10 times, she's a gravid of 10. Now, she may not have had 10 babies. She might have had you know, six babies and a couple of miscarriages and so on and so forth, but gravida refers to the number of pregnancies, and that includes the current pregnancy. Para includes, describes the number of living children who are at least 28 days gestation. Now, 28 days is up to 28 days or up to 27 days or so is considered a newborn. And a neonate, rather. And beyond that, they're considered an infant. And the reason for that is that if a neonate, so up to about the 28 days, if they develop any kind of a febrile illness, it's most likely attributable to the delivery and an infection that was transferred from mom to the baby. Beyond that period, beyond that sort of 28 days and beyond, it's likely something the baby's acquired by some of the, through some of the means. So that's why there's a neonatal age. In your directives, it says 30 days. And I don't know why they put 30 days in there, but they just put it there, I think, to keep it simple. So someone who's a multi-parent, in other words, she's delivered babies in the past, is going to deliver much more quickly. So first delivery could take hours, you know, could take over 24 hours in some cases. Second delivery probably a little quicker. Third or fourth delivery might happen, you know, in a much quicker time. So if we know mom's had has got children at home, she's going to deliver more quickly. Primips is someone who's pregnant and delivering for the first time. So we want to ask if mom's had any complications of pregnancy, any issues with high blood pressure, gestational diabetes, swelling of the ankles, seizures, is, to the best of mom's knowledge, is the baby in a head down position, or is the baby breech, any issues with fetal development that she's aware of, any miscarriages or therapeutic abortions in the past, that would count towards the number of gravidas. But not the number of paras, obviously. And we want to know if the last delivery was vaginal or whether it was C-section. So if it was C-section, we need to know for mom, is vaginal delivery going to be an issue? If she's, now, if she's crowning, if you can see the head, it doesn't matter. She's delivering vaginally anyway. But we want to know if there are any complications with deliveries. And, of course, we want to know about mom's medical history, meds, and allergies she has. So here's a quick question. Your patient's in labor and she has one child. What is her gravida and para? Gravida 2, para 1? Anyone feel the answer is something different? No? Gravida 2, para 1. So she's pregnant twice and she has one living child. So, yeah, that's good. Your patient is in labor. She's had a previous spontaneous abortion and she has two children. What's her gravida and para? So that's one. That's one. And that's two. D? Gravida 4, para 2? Anyone disagree? Gravity 4, pair 2. Good. Yeah.
Since you're talking about them having other children, what if you go to a call and there's a baby there and they have a kid with them, like one of their children?
Yeah, what do you do with the kid who's there? Yeah, good question.
Yeah. Would they stay in the back?
Yeah. Okay. Hang on. Let me answer the question. Briar, are you going to add something to that question?
Oh, or? No,
okay. So to answer that question, number one, call for a backup crew if you can. Call for a supervisor. It depends partly on the age of the child. You know, if I have a 9-year-old or something, or even a 6-year-old, we'll probably put that kid in the captain's chair in the back of the ambulance. And the kid can just sit there, strapped in. If the kid's a little smaller, we might put him in the PD, not the PD mate, but we have a pediatric pull-out thing that comes out of the captain's chair and put them in there, or put them in a car seat and strap them into the seat while mom's on the stretcher. So yeah, oftentimes we'll take the other child. It gets complicated if it's two or three children. you know, then you're going to call your supervisor. You might want to call police, and sometimes the police can make other arrangements. We'll ask mom, you know, can you give us the name and phone number of a sister or brother, or mom or dad, anyone who can come look after the kids. We'll have the police hang out there, or a paramedic supervisor hang out until you can make arrangements. So your first bet is probably to, if you don't think you can transport the other child or children, call your supervisor right away. And usually they're accessible by cell phone, and just tell them you need them at the scene and to help out. Yeah, that's a good question. So in most cases, first pregnancy, you got time. So you can time to transport to the hospital. Multiple births, it's going to be a much quicker delivery, so it's a little riskier. And one of the medics I work with, he's delivered three of his kids. He called 911, and the kids just came too quickly. Last one came on the kitchen floor. Mom said, "It's coming. I got to lay down. It's coming right now." So and he was struggling to get her pants off. "Can't you wear skirts, damn it? You're about to give birth." Briar, did you have a question?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
I don't know if this might be a stupid question, but if mom's pregnant with twins or had been pregnant with multiple babies, is that considered one pregnancy?
Yeah, that's, I believe it's a gravid of one. And you know what? It's funny. Every year someone asks me that question, and every year I second guess myself, but I think it's a gravid of one. But you might want to do a quick Google search, you know, just say, would twins be considered gravid of one? So in terms of examining mother, we do our usual ABCD. We auscultate the chest, vital signs, and if you are looking it up, let me know. Focused head to toe. That means your first objective is to find out is crowning. I used to teach with this guy, Chris, at the Michener Institute, and Chris was not bald, but shaved his head because he was near bald anyway. And he used to teach OBS, and he had quite a bit of experience delivering babies. He used to work as a critical care paramedic on the jet up in Timmins. And so he'd teach OBS, labor and delivery, and his class was in the hallway across from our office, and I could always hear Chris talking about delivering a baby. And what he did was he would wrap his fingers around his bald head and bend down and say to the students, "Okay, the baby's coming, right?" And he'd drop his fingers down his head as the baby's head was coming down. And I'd be in my office just killing myself laughing. And I could hear the students all laughing. It was just hysterical. So we want to find out if this crowning. In terms of rest exam, crowning is the most important, right? Because we're determining, is this an imminent delivery and we need to stay in delivery, or is this, have we got time and should we transport? The rest exam should include things like jugular venous distension, which would tell you there may be a problem with hypertension in this mom. Any peripheral edema, again, is a hypertensive issue. Signs of trauma, mucus plug, broken water, vaginal bleeding, any of those sorts of things. When it comes to auscultating the heart sounds, I personally stay away from auscultating heart sounds, and I'll tell you, fetal heart sounds, that is, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, you may be wondering, is there any fetal distress? Meaning, is there any excessive heart rate of the fetus or any slow heart rate of the fetus? The trouble is, you may have some difficulty finding the fetal heartbeat. You know, you can ask mom where the fetal heartbeat was last auscultated, and you can try in that area. But if you can't hear it and you can't find it, number one, you're probably wasting precious time on the scene. And number two, now you're raising mom's anxiety thinking, "Oh my God, there's no fetal heartbeat. Something's wrong with my baby," right? So if I auscultate for fetal heart sounds and I can't find it, now I've got to reassure mom that the fact that I didn't find it doesn't mean that it's absent. So generally speaking, I don't bother with a fetal heart sound unless mom, you know, begs me, in which case, you know, we'll do it in the back of the ambulance, and I'll just remind her that if I can't hear it, doesn't mean it's not there. But so that's my feeling about fetal heartbeat. There's nothing in your BLS standards that says you're required to auscultate fetal heart sounds. So you want to keep the scene time brief if you're going to be transporting the patient. If you're going to be delivering, then you're going to be staying on the scene, right? So here's another question. Your pregnant patient has three children at home. What is her gravida in para? Four and three? So B, good. Your pregnant patient has had two spontaneous abortions and two children at home. What's her gravida and para? 5 and 2? Or D? Okay, 5 and 2 is correct. Good. Yeah, I don't know what happened to the right answer there. Okay, so transport to the hospital. Oxygen is on a PRN basis, so if mom's sat is fine, her oxygen saturation is fine, I wouldn't worry about oxygen therapy. The only time I would worry about oxygen therapy is if you're worried there's something wrong with the baby. If, for example, mom says to you, the last time she was examined, the obstetrician thought the baby might be putting pressure on the cord, or every delivery I've ever had, there's been a prolapsed cord or a compressed cord, then I would go ahead and give mom oxygen by nasal prongs, probably at high liter flow, or NRB, but I usually give nasal prongs, maybe 6 to 8 liters. It's a little higher than normal, but position mom comfortable. We put mom in left lateral position. That's because in the third trimester of pregnancy, so in the last 3-4 months, a gravid uterus will compress the vena cava and decrease venous return, so decrease preload. And so what we do is we take a rolled up blanket and just put it under mom's right hip in the back of the ambulance, and that sort of tilts her a little towards her left, and that takes the pressure off the vena cava, so left lateral tilt. Always remember that you're caring for two patients. If I'm on the scene with a mom who's in labor and the birth is imminent, we call a backup crew. And as much as I don't like this, the policy for most paramedic services is one crew transports mom, the other crew transports baby. Because technically you can't safely secure a baby in the back of the ambulance. Now the neomate might make a difference, but the neomate is intended to go on the stretcher, and that means mom has to sit in a chair, which is not really appropriate if she hasn't delivered the placenta yet or something like that. So usually one ambulance each. And it's not great for mom, it's not great for care overall, but that's typically what we do for safety. So we monitor vitals, SpO2, ECG, IV, PRN. I won't start an IV if it's a full gestation, there were no complications, I won't bother starting an IV on mom, but if there were any other issues, I might start an IV on mom. And if we're transporting without delivering, we should keep scene time to a minimum. We want to monitor the frequency and intensity of the contractions, reassess the urge to push, reassess for crowning, and always have the obstetrical kit nearby. So we'll bring the obstetrical kit into the call with us. It usually comes in a cardboard box wrapped in plastic, and we'll take that in with us. I used to carry one in the trunk of my car. I don't know why. I was thinking if, as long as I have an OBS kit, no one's going to deliver a baby, you know. And but you know, when I was younger in my early career, you know, I went to a lot of pool parties and things like that where there were women pregnant, because when you're 20s and 30s, everybody's pregnant, right, getting married. So I thought, I got to carry an OBS kit. Somebody's going to deliver a baby. And I've been a shit magnet on my time off my entire life. So if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen on my days off. So when do you transport and stay? Stay when you see crowning. That's what crowning looks like. Okay with that image? You good? Mm-hmm. Prepare to deliver. Call for backup ambulance. I'm going to hope both patients will be fine, but we always prepare to resuscitate if we need to. That's it for that. Any questions about maternal assessment so far? We haven't even started the delivering of the baby part yet. Mm-hmm. You good?